Let's start off with the situation in Barrier Lake. So I guess to start off, who are the indigenous people who are in this region?
Okay, well, the people are the Algonquins, who are, you know, throughout the region of Quebec, and I believe in Ontario as well. The people central to the Barrier Lake area are, I can't actually pronounce their true name, but they're primarily focused, live at the Rapid Lake Reserve, which is a small 59-acre area that Quebec acknowledges as their only legal territory. But they have a traditional territory that spans about 10,000 square kilometers in eastern Quebec, a couple hundred kilometers north of Ottawa, probably more than that. But anyways, yeah, and like many other indigenous peoples in the region, including Grassy Narrows, the folks at Barrier Lake have been, you know, their lands have been hounded by logging companies. They've been dealing with that since the 60s. And you know, it continues to this very moment. I guess I should back up a bit here. In 1990, the Algonquins at Barrier Lake managed to get Canada and Quebec to sign a landmark agreement known as the Trilateral Agreement, which was a plan to jointly co-manage the traditional territory, the 10,000 acres, and it would also enable Barrier Lake to protect their traditional way of life, their sacred sites, their hunting grounds, and receive a meager sum of money per year from all industrial activities in the area, including logging, hydro, and tourism. 1.5 out of every $100 million made, as far as I know. It was amazing that Canada and Quebec even signed it. But you know, their activities since then have been, you know, very much opposed to that, to the spirit of the agreement and their apparent willingness to accept to it, because they've been, Canada in particular has bent over backwards to try and take over the Band Council, and they've tried to do so repeatedly. I'm not sure how familiar your listeners are to it, but I guess the most infamous case was known as the coup d'etat that Canada tried to carry out in, I believe it was 2006 or 2008, in which it tried to force into power a chief and council of their own choosing. A couple of years earlier, they had also tried to place the reserve under third-party management, which is, they wanted to bring in a third-party manager from some big corporation, probably from the U.S., to manage Barrier Lake's affairs and finances in particular. they've been doing this repeatedly, and you know, Barrier Lake's been doing its best to oppose this, but you know, they've been, you know, confronted repeatedly with violence, because Quebec, as I'm sure everybody recognizes, has been a very difficult government to work with when it comes to indigenous rights. OCA speaks well to that. That could have been easily resolved, but instead they went all out, and they've been doing that with Barrier Lake as well. The protests have been constantly met with violence, where, you know, children have been sprayed in the face with pepper spray, and women have been, you know, kicked to the ground with pain compliance techniques and whatnot. So the situation now has been a little different. There was a leadership division in the community, which Canada also tried to exploit, but it ultimately backfired in Canada's face, because the two divisions that were in the community, you know, because Canada has been, you know, really driving a wedge between everybody, you know, to divide and conquer, but it ultimately brought everybody together, at least tentatively, to deal with the larger problem, you know, being Canada and you know, the government's refusal and Quebec's refusal to, you know, deal with the Algonquins responsibly, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, consultation and consent, which, well, we shouldn't even mention consent because, you know, no government and no province in Canada wants to mention that word. But anyways, but the situation most recently was involving Resolute Forest Products, which began illegally operating in Barrier Lake's traditional territory, specifically in an area that includes sacred sites and important hunting grounds. Now, knowing all too well that if they organized blockades or any, you know, serious protests, they would, you know, again be attacked, so they took a different approach by organizing a camp and impressively managing to stop Resolute Forest Products operations. In fact, there's like some great images. Indigenous People Solidarity Movement and Barrier Lake Solidarity have been out there too, and then they got some great photos of you know, the Algonquins escorting these massive machines, you know, away from the territory. There's also, you know, a big demonstration outside of Resolute Forest Products offices and Premier Jean Charest's offices in Montreal. This just happened like less than a week ago. But so what's important here is that, you know, as a result of these, you know, efforts and the fact that, you know, the media was actually taking an interest in the situation, which is, you know, quite different from the past. Quebec agreed to sit down with community representatives to negotiate, some kind of agreement. And the agreement turned out to be, you know, Quebec and the forestry company conceding to Barrier Lake in one key area, and that is in their willingness to adhere to the measures to harmonize, which is a provision in the 1991 Trilateral Agreement, which is what Barrier Lake has been ultimately struggling for since it was signed. And the central thing behind the measures to harmonize is the understanding that logging operations are not to compromise the way that the Algonquins use the land. As Barrier Lake put it, logging is not allowed to happen where the community has hunting cabins and areas of moose and bear habitats, sacred areas, medicinal sites, and others, and other areas of concern. So, you know, that's a pretty big victory, I think, especially given how hard that everybody, being Canada and Quebec and the companies, have been working to you know, have the Trilateral Agreement thrown out so they can just, you know, do what, you know, companies always do with their colonial methodology, is just, you know, move in, take what they want, and leave. Now there's still a lot of work to be done to, you know, secure the Algonquin's territory, and unfortunately, you know, as a result of negotiations, the Algonquins of Barrier Lake also had to concede a little bit of land to the forestry company, which has some people confused. But you know, it's been pretty difficult, I think, for them dealing with Quebec. And they're, you know, trying to find a balanced approach here so they can, you know, live, you know, coexist, in fact, you know, with Quebec. So, you know, there's still some logging taking place, but if Quebec upholds, you know, its word, then at least, you know, the important areas are going to be preserved, and perhaps they can, if Barrier Lake can secure some legal support, you know, they can pursue, you know, the larger issues, you know, the long term. So that's pretty much the situation.
Yeah. So, you know. So I'm curious, what is the long term? When you said, so then they maybe can start addressing the long term issues. What are the long term issues in this?
Well, I can't speak for their thoughts on that, but I would think it would be, you know, securing their land rights, And mm-hmm. you know, and that's, you know, that goes for, you know, everybody in Canada. You know, that's the central issue for every Indigenous nation. In fact, you know, not just Canada, but everywhere. You know, it's great to have an agreement, and it's great for a government to uphold it. But you know, at the same time, you know, agreements are pieces of paper, and pieces of paper can be burned, and you know, ink can be changed. So the long-term issue is, I don't know, you know, raising the consciousness of the government, you know, maturing people to the point where they are actually willing to let the Algonquins do what they want to do, you know, live peacefully and just have that be the end of it, you know, instead of continually, you know, putting these people under siege, and because it's, you know, beyond ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you actually answered in your whole explanation there. You kind of answered all my questions I had about the situation with the Algonquins and at Barrier Lake. So I think we're going to move on to this next one that you wanted to highlight today was the in Sweden, the Sami. So
yeah.
So I thought this story when I was reading it, I thought was just fascinating. So who are the Sami, John?
Okay, well, they're essentially they're reindeer herders who live in an Arctic area known as Sapmi, S-A-P-M-I, which stretches across northern Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. You know, they've been in the area at least 12,000 years, and I guess their population these days is about 180,000. You know, they're quite similar to Indigenous peoples here historically. You know, their livelihoods are centered around coastal fishing, fur trapping, and sheep herding. But you know, reindeer herding is their main practice, and hunting, but not so much anymore. And they've also faced their own. I don't want to say that, but they've faced a lot of colonial policies. You know, relentless policies, particularly in Norway and Sweden in the 19th century. Norway at one point went on a mission to quote-unquote unify the country's cultural language, which meant Sami cultural language had to go. Their approach there, though, was mostly they took the same approach as
the residential
schools. Cold War approach. I can't remember the word right now, but anyways, they didn't take a brute force method to distinguish it. You know, they wanted to erase the Sami's economy. But that ultimately failed. Sweden, on the other hand, started sterilizing Sami women, using the Sami for race research. And that, you know, around the same time this was happening, the Nazis rose up and they, you know, had issues with the Sami, so they, you know, destroyed all their existing houses and visible traces of Sami life in northern Finland and Norway. You know, and for the last 40 years, they've been dealing with all sorts of different development projects, and that's what they're mainly dealing with today. Fortunately, the Sami are pretty well organized politically. In fact, they created the very first Indigenous non-governmental organization in the 50s. This was before the AFN and you know, Red Power and Indian International Treaty Council and all these other groups. You know, the Sami were the first. And
So what is the issue here? I believe that there's issue with these mining companies.
The main thing now for the Sami is defending their territory and ensuring that they can continue to practice their reindeer herding practices.
So who are the two companies? Because I guess there's an Australian one and a British one, correct?
Yeah, the British one is Beowulf, and the Australian company is Scandinavian Resources.
Okay.
There's a long story, I think, behind that name, but anyways, they're both trying to get going with different iron mines on the Sami's territory. and they've been speaking out quite a bit over it. In fact, I didn't even really know about the Sami and until they started focusing on this. But I guess that's kind of how everybody comes to my attention, you know, when they start protesting us, when I find out about them. But you know, anyways, you know, they're not they don't really focus on blockades so much, I guess. They've been trying to take a very diplomatic approach to the situation. But like they caught they caught Beowulf breaking the law, which I think helped them a lot. They caught the company illegally drilling exploratory wells on their territories. Not only illegal because they didn't consult anybody, they didn't consult the Sami, but also because it was in breach of the Swedish Minerals Act. So then the Sami, you know, headed over to the government of Sweden to let them know. And thankfully, you know, the Sweden government, you know, forced the company to stop drilling. I think that this happened last September. I'm sure the company is still pursuing the mine, but you know, there was a couple other. The company also breached its own ethical guidelines by refusing to consult the Sami. So they're probably not going to go forward anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
The real troublemaker, though, right now is Scandinavian Resources, which is financed by a Canadian investment firm.
Do you know the name of that investment firm?
Yep, it's Canaccord Capital Corporation.
Okay.
In fact, I'd like to mention a good website here if anybody wants to learn about the people behind all these mining companies that are, you know, exploiting Indigenous lands. There's a website called moneytometal.org, and it's organized, I believe, by the people who organize the minesandcommunities.org. Which is another great resource. But anyways, moneytometal.org, you know, they name all the names, you know, all the financiers of Goldcorp and Barrick Gold and all these other troublemakers. So anyways, yeah, and they're trying to push for two mines in this area that is, you know, it's like the heartland of the Sami's territory. And right now they're they just announced in June that they're teaming up with Greenpeace, and they're taking the issue to the UN, who will probably you know, support the Sami, because they've been involved in UN efforts for quite some time now. They also organized a couple protests. Unfortunately, they haven't been you know, they haven't had to deal with any kind of heavy hands. Not like Barrier Lake.
and isn't that sad to say that? And I said, and isn't that sad to say that there's a more heavy hand here than in other places, right?
Yeah, well, you know, like I could think of some scathing remarks there, but well, you know, like I often find myself when I look at all these issues. In fact, as we look into the next situation that we're going to talk about, that'll reveal kind of my. Why I'm saying this, I often compare Canada's, you know, policies and approach toward Indigenous peoples as the same as those of Botswana and Colombia, you know, and all these other, you know, heavy human rights abusers who couldn't care less about the Indigenous populations. Of course, Canada is less inclined to take the heavy hand approach that it, you know, once did. You know, they're more about the pen than the sword. Nowadays, at least, but still, like the logic behind it, you know, the reasoning and the intent and the you know, the long term goal of Canada, you know, which is to, you know, erase Indigenous culture, to, you know, assimilate everybody, and I don't know, as far as I can tell, they want to turn reserves into specialized work farms for the mining industry. At least that's what. That seems to be the approach these days, but
yeah.
The ultimate goal is to erase everybody.
Yeah, but getting back to the Sami in Sweden now, and talking about this, so like it's interesting that there's two, like the one mining company is sort of backed off, the British one, this other one, this Australian one with backing from Canada is kind of being a little bit more hard-nosed about it. So explain what's the Swedish government's take on this, because I thought that was interesting too.
That's a good question. I'm I think they generally support the Sami, I think.
Yeah.
Unless your research has shown otherwise.
Well, it was just from the article that there was in the discussion on the comments, it seemed like there was a back and forth in saying that the Swedish government seems to be supporting the Sami.
Yeah. Well, even with acknowledging their territory, like a big part of their territory in Sweden has become a World Heritage Site. That's a
mm-hmm.
which is, I guess, a notable achievement. But the Sweden government has also, you know, put its own official spin on various areas of the Sami territory, you know, to support their culture and to ensure their continued survival. Which is refreshing, and that's kind of why I wanted to talk about them today, because, you know, with so many of the situations around the world, you know, there aren't very many governments that are, you know, actually so willing to support indigenous peoples, you know. There's a few, like Bolivia and Venezuela, and, you know, doing a pretty good job. But even in Europe, like, there's actually quite a few different indigenous populations, you know, in Europe and Asia, who are dealing with, you know, governments that really don't care, eh? And,
right.
But yeah, Sweden's been doing pretty good, I think. You know, they haven't been, you know, going all crazy or nothing.
Yeah. Now let's talk about this third situation in Botswana.
Hmm.
So this is the Kalahari Bushmen. Talk a bit about who these people are.
Okay. Historically they were straight up nomads who lived in the in central Botswana. And their population is pretty big. It's about 90,000 altogether. But they're actually located. The Bushmen, who are also known as the San, though that's a pretty offensive term, are located throughout Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, and Angola. In each region, wherever the San peoples live, you know, they've faced their own hardships. The situation in Botswana has been. Is fairly well known, because of the involvement of Survival International and the support and the campaigning that they've done on behalf of the population in Botswana. In the 1960s, their territory was consumed by the Central Kalahari Game Reserve, which a park that was, you know, ostensibly created to protect the people, but more accurately, you know, the animals in the area. And since the mid 1990s, especially, Botswana has been on a mission to get rid of the Bushmen and their way of life, and quite literally clear every single man, woman, and child out of their central out of their territory. And there's mixed reasons as to why that is. You know, the main reason, the obvious reason, and the, you know, confessed reason, is because of the diamonds in the region, on their territory. You know, there's a whole lot of diamonds there. But the Botswana government also takes a very harsh look. They don't like the Bushmen. They see them as primitive, backward, inferior, stupid fools who are, you know, living a painful life of exile, following Stone Age ways, and who need to be "quote unquote" elevated to the gloriousness of civilization. in a nutshell, that's, you know, those are all words that various officials have used at one point or another.
Yeah, and ironic that it is that those same sort of things were probably talked about just generally people in Africa, right? A century ago, and now an African government is saying about that, about people that live within its own borders.
Well, there's plenty of governments in Africa who've kind of, caught the colonial bug, and they've been well, they've bought into the promise of civilization,
mm-hmm.
you know, and as a result of that, and this is my own opinion, I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems like Botswana in particular wants to get away from its own history as far as it can, and so as a result of that fear or whatever, they're lashing out at the Bushmen.
They'll talk about this issue with the drinking water. At first, they were, well, I guess we should go back a bit. In early, I guess it was 2002, they were forced to relocate?
Well, actually, that goes back even further.
Okay.
There have been three major evictions, 97, 2002, and 2005. In all three cases, they were shipped off to relocation camps far away from their territory, far enough that they could never walk back on their own. The government also began criminalizing the Bushmen's hunting practices. But then, I'm not sure who was involved in exactly, but the Bushmen went to Botswana's court, and a year after the final eviction in 2005, they won a key judgment that said the government's actions were unlawful and unconstitutional, and that the government was wrong for forcibly and wrongfully depriving them of their possessions, and that paved the way for their return home. But the Botswana government didn't look too kindly on that ruling. So, in fact, one of their first responses to that ruling was to cap the only water borehole that was that the San had access to. So they cut off their supply of water. They also, you know, continued criminalizing hunters, and on at least one occasion, a couple years later, like I think it's 2007, 2008, they confiscated all of the Bushmen's goats because apparently it didn't fit the image of the game reserve that they wanted to promote. So no hunting, no water, no goats.
Jeez.
You know, yeah, it's
bizarre.
Like, they wanted them to starve or yeah. leave. And this, of course, is the process of elevation. And then, meanwhile, of course, you know, De Beers had a diamond mine going on the territory, and they had access to, you know, all the water they could ever need, you know, thousands and thousands of gallons, I imagine. You know, more. They probably use more in a day than the San would use in a year. But you know, Survival International engaged in a pretty effective campaign that you know, embarrassed and shamed De Beers into selling its deposit to Gem Diamonds for like a twentieth of its actual value, market value. Anyways, but then you know. There's so much going on. It's been crazy.
Yeah.
I guess the situation with the water borehole has been difficult for the SAM because you know they want to go home, and the relocation camps they've been living in have been hell. You know, alcoholism has become an issue for the Bushmen, and it never was before. Sexually transmitted diseases has become an issue. You know, they can't hunt. You know, they're living in settlement camps. You know, they can't, you know, walk around, which is, you know, in vast distances, which is what they're accustomed to.
So, as I understand it now, there was this declaration where they do have access to drinking water now?
This has been a recent development. In 2011, Botswana's court affirmed once again that the Bushmen do in fact have the right, you know, to water, and specifically to the old borehole that the Botswana government capped a few years back. But, you know, once again, Botswana lashed out by approving a $3 billion diamond mine close to one particular community, and that, you know, approval was reportedly issued on the condition that Gem Diamonds, who owned the deposit, denied the Bushmen any access to water. It's not clear whether or not that's true. What is clear is that Gem Diamonds was approached by Vox United, which is a nonprofit group based in the UK, and they ended up forming a partnership to supply, to provide the indigenous residents with access to water at four villages. It's also worth noting that consultations were carried out before the partnership moved forward. In the first water borehole, which was the old one, was re-drilled in September 2011. And since then, like the Bushmen have continued to have access to water. I don't think any other of the boreholes have been drilled yet, because Vox United has to raise the money, I believe, and they have to bring in special equipment or something. But I'm sure Jim Diamonds could easily afford it. But anyways, they finally have access to water. Unfortunately, they're still being persecuted for hunting. Just last June, reports came in that security forces had arrested a group of Bushmen for possessing meat from animals from the area, and apparently also a group of security forces have moved into the region relatively close to the water borehole. Which I believe is also relatively close to the diamond mine that's owned by Gem Diamonds. So there's a lot of tension there, and there was some concern also earlier this year that they were going to come in and evict everybody, but that never materialized, thankfully. But anyways, the situation is tense, and sadly, Botswana hasn't really changed its views about the San and their culture. We hope they will, especially given the fact that, the notion of indigenous rights and the respect for traditional cultures are actually on the rise in Africa. In Tanzania, for example, they created a new constitution which acknowledged to a certain extent indigenous rights, and there's been further acknowledgement in a few other countries. South Africa has started acknowledging certain aspects of indigenous rights, because they have big populations there. But, it's hoped that Botswana will, do the same. It's hard to say if they will, though.